Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you for coming out and to the bookstore, and thank you for supporting your independent and local booksellers and businesses, because it really does make a difference. I know many of you are pretty familiar with tonight's author's first book, first novel, Rules of Civility, when it first came out in hardcover, and it's now available in a paperback. I know it got so much, so many rave reviews, and I've heard so many good things from customers and our staff over the last little bit, just saying this wonderful novel of New York in 1938, of love, of coming of age, of the society and high society and the parties and all that is just such a treat. The thing that I want to say that as I've been reading it, that makes this so different from other books that I've read, certainly, and the period, is just how vivid it all is, that the author makes this time period with the details and the feeling and the look of the period. It feels like you can walk into a party there with Katie Conten and order a margarita, or not a margarita, a martini. I knew I was going to make that mistake. Okay, this is the South. We're in the West. I meant martini. I was thinking that. There we go. So, without further ado, because I'm getting out of the way, I want to introduce Amor Toth.
Thank you. All right. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Just out of interest, I don't want to be a spoiler, how many of you have read the book? Okay, well, that's good. That's good. I won't spoil the ending for most of you. I'm Amor Toth. I was raised in the Boston area. And I moved to New York City at the age of 25. When I first came to the city, I lived with a childhood friend in an illegal sublet on the Lower East Side, and our next-door neighbor was the New York City headquarters of the Hells Angels. And so it's what many people call the safest block in New York, for good reason. But on a Saturday morning, shortly after I arrived in New York, I was walking down Houston Street, just a few blocks from our place, to get breakfast. And as I was going down Houston Street, an older gentleman with a long gray beard and dark clothing approached me, and he says, "Excuse me, but are you the sort of person that if you meet a stranger who needs help, that you would give this stranger help?" And I was thinking to myself, well, that's a hell of a question. But I was kind of thinking, yeah, I'd like to think I'm the kind of person that would help somebody who I bumped into in the street. So I said, yeah, sure, I'm your man. What, you know, what can I do for you? And he says, oh, good. Come this way. So he leads me into a sort of a two-story gray building on the corner. I'd passed it 100 times, and I'd never even noticed it. And he takes me through the door, and we go down a narrow staircase into the basement. And this must have been before I saw Silence of the Lambs, because I don't know what I was thinking. But nonetheless, I follow this nice gentleman into the basement, and there in the basement are a series of tables covered with food, surrounded with men, women, and children, and they're in the dark. And now what this is, of course, in retrospect, was this is an Orthodox synagogue, a Jewish synagogue. And in the Orthodox tradition, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And in the strict interpretation of Orthodoxy, that includes you're not allowed to use machinery. You're not allowed to turn on and off machines on Saturdays. So the tradition is you turn on the lights on Friday night, and you just leave them on. And that way, when you arrive on Saturday, the lights are all set and nobody has to do anything. But so someone had obviously carelessly turned off the lights on Friday night, and the congregation has found themselves gathered in the dark. Now, in Orthodoxy, it's also against the rules to ask somebody to do work for you. That's viewed as cheating. You know, in this terrifically roundabout way, this older gentleman starts saying, As you go around the room, if you see a string hanging from the ceiling and you're curious as to the purpose of the string, you should explore your curiosity. And so I'm getting the picture. So I start to walk around the room, and I'm kind of pulling strings and turning on lights. And young men are kind of jumping off of benches, saying, "No, you must stop him. What is he doing? What is he doing?" And the old man saying, "No, it's okay. Go with God. Go with God." So showing the wisdom of his age, I guess. A few years after this, I was dating the woman who is my wife, and I think in the manner of young people everywhere, we would celebrate the first anniversary of our date. Our first date. And we weren't married yet, so that was the anniversary that we'd celebrate. It's the first date. And for us, the big anniversary place was the Union Square Cafe, which is still a terrific restaurant in the city. And it's terrific in part, and it's very popular because it's very nice, but it's not overly precious or pretentious. It's not super expensive. But it was a little over our heads, and of course that's part of the point. So you save up a little money and you put on your best clothes and you go. So we arrive, and the maitre d' is showing us to a little table for two along the wall, where these little tables for two all lined up. And as we're approaching our table for two, I see that there's a 60-year-old man seated at the table right next to where we're going to be seated, and I recognize him. He was the father of a friend of mine, and I had met him once or twice, two or three times, and he was something of a figure in New York in the 80s. He had been involved in some major transactions. His picture was in the New York Times a good deal, kind of ended up in the histories of finance of the times. So recognizing him, I decided, I'm sticking my hand out as we approach the table to say, "Hi, I'm Amor Towles, and I know your daughter, and we met once or twice." And as I'm doing this, somebody brushes past my shoulder, and it's a woman returning from the washroom, but it's not his wife. So I carefully retract my hand, and I don't introduce myself. Now, he didn't make eye contact with me, and he wouldn't recognize me anyway. I'm just one of the thousands of young of his friends, of his children. So my wife is seated next to him, and I'm seated next to this woman. And as she presumably sort of gathers herself after her visit to the washroom, the maitre d' is describing, or the waiter is describing to us the specials for the evening, and we place our order. And then, once we've done that, she looks up and she says, "For 7 years, you've been promising me you're going to leave that woman. When are you going to do the right thing?" I'm like, "Oh my God, you got to be kidding me." So sure enough, appetizer, an entree, dessert, espresso, we get the whole thing. The whole history of the relationship and the promises and him waffling and the children and the money and this and that. So and it's like, "Happy anniversary, honey." It's for me, but at the time, as someone in my mid-20s, what really struck me, what I thought was so funny about this, was that here's this guy who's obviously very accomplished. He's a very intelligent gentleman, very savvy, very accomplished, as I say. And somehow he had gotten it into his head that to go from his apartment on 85th Street in Central Park down to a restaurant at 15th Street in Manhattan, that was far enough to go to have lunch with your mistress and be discreet, somehow. So, but now, having lived in New York for close to 25 years now, I think this is kind of crazy wisdom to this gentleman's viewpoint. Because for those of you who know Manhattan, you'll know that between 85th Street and 15th Street, there are actually 20 different microcosms. There's neighborhoods that are defined around ethnicity, around religion, around social class, around age, around lifestyle. Each of these 20 microcosms kind of having their own way of life and their own tempo and their own services, their own people. So from his state of mind, to go to have lunch across this galaxy of 20 separate microcosms, it is kind of, I guess he could sort of think, surprising that you would run into somebody you know. Now, of course, I tell these stories side by side because there I am when I arrive at New York, and my next door neighbor is the Hell's Angels headquarters, and around the corner is this Orthodox Jewish community meeting on a weekly basis. And if you think of those two constituencies, they could not be farther apart in terms of you know, their lifestyle, their music, their cuisine, their fashion, you know. So, and yet there they are coexisting a few blocks apart, probably passing each other in the street occasionally without, you know, maybe, you know, without making much ado about it. But that's the nature of Manhattan, is that you have this incredible density of a variety of different types of people side by side. I think one interesting accident of history that adds to this sort of complexity, this intricate complexity of what I like to think of as almost the chessboard of New York, with each of its little squares being defined around these various factors. One accident of history that has added the complexity is 20 feet of water. And the reason I say that is because if you think about New York, for 100 years, it's been a cultural capital. It's been a financial capital. It's been a capital of fashion. Sort of an aristocracy was gathered there 100 years ago, and you have the museums and the banks, and that all makes sense. And now Paris and London are very much like that. For, you know, even for longer than New York has been, they've been cultural capitals with finance and fashion and museums, et cetera. And all three of those cities are on rivers. You know, so you got the London is on the Thames, and Paris is on the Seine, and New York is, of course, on the Hudson and the East Rivers. But the big difference between these three capitals and how they're situated is that the Seine is very shallow. The Thames, which is a little bit deeper, in a shallow spot is about 10 feet deep. Now, the Hudson in a shallow spot is 30 feet deep, the 20 feet of water. And in a deep spot, the Hudson is 200 feet deep. Now, what this has meant in terms of the development of these three different metropolitan areas is that well into the 20th century, beyond 1950, New York's docks in Manhattan were very active. Now, you can bring an aircraft carrier up to 42nd Street in New York City. There's actually one not far from there right now. You can bring a cruise ship, a 10-story contemporary cruise ship, right up to the dock on 42nd Street. They arrive every day, and that's, you know, you see the tourists come and board and go off to the Caribbean. But in a way, more importantly, for the development of the history of the city, from 1880 to 1960 or what have you, those were freight boats that were pulling up to those docks. And if you've got a dock that can take a freight boat, then what you end up with are, first of all, manufacturing can be right there in Manhattan, because you're going to unload, literally, the products that you're making right onto the boats, literally across the street. And you're also obviously taking in goods. And that brings other elements with it, too. When you've got ships from around the world pulling up to Manhattan to unload their goods throughout the 20th century, you're getting this wide array of ethnic arrivals, different from the great immigration wave of Ellis Island, but complementing it. You know, people arriving every day from around the world, some who stay for a day, some who stay for 3 days, some who never leave. They just get off the boat and you know, plant their flag. But you end up with a manufacturing population in Manhattan. You end up with social activism, union movement in Manhattan, that kind of are evolving side by side with this aristocratic, cultural, financial population. Whereas in Paris, that set of influences that I just described was in Marseille, basically, and similar places. And in London, it was often Liverpool. So those cities were growing up kind of in mirror opposite directions, but in Manhattan, one was laid over the other. And this, as I say, adds to kind of the complexity of the chessboard that is Manhattan. I wasn't sure I was going to tell the story, but I'll tell it to you. I knew a man who was older than me who was in finance, and at some point in the 1970s, he was at J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan decides that they're thinking about trading gold, going into the gold trading business, and so they're evaluating this as a potential complement to their other financial services, and the partners are discussing the opportunity. And what comes up as a problem is that if you're going to trade gold, then actually you have to have some gold. You have to take possession of it. You have to deliver it. And a lot of the older partners were worried about this concept of having gold in the J.P. Morgan bank. Where do you put it? You know, and how do you get it from spot A to spot B? They were convinced that they would be robbed. And that was reason enough to avoid it. So there's some debate about this, and they sort of say, well, you know, how are we going to determine the risk of being robbed of our gold, if we go into this business? And the gentleman who I know, who was a partner, kind of raises his hand, and he says, you know, this is a funny thing, but I frequent an Italian restaurant on the Upper East Side, and the gentleman two tables away from me, whenever I dine there, is apparently a member of the mob. And they said, oh, that's great. Go ask him. Ask him his, you know, ask him his opinion, what we should do. So he says, okay. So he goes to the restaurant early one night, and he approaches this mobster and who sits alone in a booth, and he says, you know, hi, we've met once or twice, you know, through the owner of the restaurant, and I'm a partner of J.P. Morgan. And he kind of explains the situation and this inquiry that they have at the partner's level, you know, would they be robbed? And the mobster kind of looks at him, and he says, well, I've got one real comment for you, and that is shrimp. And my acquaintance says, well, you know, what do you mean, shrimp? What are you saying? And the guy kind of, you know, rolls his eyes, and he says, listen, stealing things is a difficult business, and selling stolen goods is a difficult business. He says, if you look at shrimp, though, it's very expensive per pound. It arrives in New York City every morning in many different locations, many places that you can take it from. There are thousands of restaurants in the city that will buy it from you later that day. And by tomorrow morning, the evidence is gone. He's like, we will never steal your gold. But anyway, I love the fact that the fact that J.P. Morgan is seeking advice from a mobster just because you have the, you know, side by side. But anyway, but so as I say, that's a divergence. But one of the interesting paradox of the city, and there are a number, but one is that one aspect of New York City over its life, but certainly in the 1930s when my book takes place, one paradox is that it is an environment where you would often go into public to find privacy. Now, what I mean by that is that if you think of the life of a young woman in the 1930s, the life of, you know, my character, or of the young women that Edward Hopper had depicted in many of his paintings in New York during this time, their lives were very crowded. You know, their apartment where they lived, if they lived at home with their family, you would probably have three or four generations in a single apartment. You might have five siblings. You're sharing beds and things like that. If you'd gotten out of that and you'd moved into a boarding house, then even there, you probably had a roommate, and you might be on a floor with 20 other girls sharing a single bath. On your way to work, you're going to get sort of shoved into the subway by the conductors, you know, pushed into the thing, into the sardine can of the subway. And when you got to work, you might be in a secretarial pool, like my character, sort of surrounded by other young women. You know, God forbid, you were in a manufacturing environment in Manhattan at the time, you know, in a seamstress floor, where there might be 100 young women or older women lined up side by side in terrible working conditions. It was, as I say, a crowded environment from the beginning through the middle to the end of your day. And so in the places that you situated. But so where you would go to get your privacy were in public places. You'd go to the cafe, the diner at the off hour, like Edward Hopper depicts, the Nighthawks at the Diner painting that you can probably visualize. You might go to the movie theater by yourself. You might ride the subway at an off hour. But what you'd find is one of these little spots where the city was not crouching around you, and you could have your kind of your moment to yourself. Now, pulling this together for a second, if you are in a place like Manhattan in the 30s, where you have all these various constituencies crowded in together, coming from around the world, the different social classes piled in together, the different religions, the different lifestyles, and you as a habit go into public to get a little bit of privacy, you go to a cafe that you frequent, and you sit in that little table by yourself. What you've done is you've got the foundation for where chance encounters can occur quite easily, and they really can change the trajectory of your life. Because if you are sitting at that little cafe table and someone happens to take the seat next to you, or you strike up a conversation with the person across from you on the train, I can almost guarantee you that person is from a totally different walk of life from you. Now, in many parts of this country, not to their discredit, but where if you went out and sat down at a place like that, the person at the other table might be very much like you. And you might have a very nice conversation, but it might reinforce the existing state of affairs in your life, rather than send you off in a new direction. But if you bring in someone from a totally different walk of life and you take your conversation forward, then you've got a little bit more possibility, a little bit more combustibility, a little bit more chemistry that things might end differently for you that year than you thought they were going to when it began. And this is a central theme, obviously, of my book, for those who've read it. Katie, the narrator, the main character, who's of working class background, goes out on New Year's Eve with her boarding house roommate. They sit down in a low-rent jazz bar in Greenwich Village, and it just so happens that a young man in a cashmere coat sits at the table next to them. His brother never arrives, and so the three of them strike up a conversation and start banding about, and this sets in motion a sequence of events that does change the trajectory of their various lives. What I'd like to do, though, kind of in the spirit of that, is read a few pages of the book from more in the middle of the book, and then I'll open it up to questions. But to set this up, those three characters I just described, Katie, her roommate Eve, the young man in the cashmere coat who's named Tinker, at the midpoint of the book, Tinker and circumstances are such that Tinker and Eve have shot off to the Mediterranean, having a very nice time on the Côte d'Azur. And Katie's kind of been left behind. She's moved out of the boarding house, and she's taken a room apartment by herself in a 6-story walk-up, kind of a one-room apartment. She's feeling a little frustrated by her life in the secretarial pool. And so she's a little dispirited. And to shake things up for herself, she quits her job, and she talks her way into a job as an assistant working for a venerable old editor at an old world distinguished publishing house. Now, when this old editor offers her the job as his assistant, he encourages her to turn him down, saying that a job with him at this time in his life, first of all, the pay would be terrible. But second of all, a job with him would be a cul-de-sac. It would be a dead end. She takes the job anyway. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read kind of two quick scenes from the end of that first week of Katie working at the Pembroke Press. Excuse me. The pay was terrible. On my first Friday, when I went down to payroll to pick up my check, I was still in the dark. Looking around, I took heart from the fact that the other girls were chirpy and well-dressed. But when I opened the envelope, I discovered that my new weekly rate was half of what I'd made at Quiggin and Hale. Half. Oh my God, I thought. What have I done? I took another look at the girls around me who, with blasé smiles, had begun chattering about where they intended to weekend, and it hit me. Of course they were blasé. They didn't need the paycheck. That's the difference between being a secretary and an assistant. A secretary exchanges her labor for a living wage, but an assistant comes from a fine home, attends Smith College, and lands her position when her mother happens to be seated beside the publisher at a dinner party. But while Mr. Parrish had been right on this account, he couldn't have been more wrong about the job being a cul-de-sac. As I stood in the payroll department, licking my wounds, Susie Vanderwyl asked if I wanted to join a few of the other assistants for a splash. Sure, I thought, why not? What better reason for a drink than looming penury? At Quiggin and Hale, when you went out with the girls, you'd hoof around the corner of the local well, snipe about your day, speculate on inter-office pinching, and then head for the elevated, insufficiently soused. But when we walked out of the Pembroke Press, Susie hailed a cab. We all hopped in and headed to the St. Regis Hotel, where Susie's brother Dickie, a floppy-bang, gregarious sort freshly out of college, was waiting in the King Cole Bar. In company were two of Dickie's classmates from Princeton and a roommate from prep school. "Hello, sis." "Hello, Dickie. You know Helen. This is Jenny and Katie." Dickie rattled off introductions like a machine gun. "Jenny, TJ. TJ, Helen. Helen, Welly. Welly, Katie. Roberto, Roberto." Then he slapped his hands together. "Right then, what'll it be?" Gin and tonics were ordered for all. Then Dickie ran off to roust up club chairs from around the bar. He pushed them up to our table, ramming them into each other like the bumper cars at Coney Island. Within minutes, there was some story about how Roberto, under the influence of Bacchus and in the bad graces of Poseidon, had gone astray in the fog off Fisher's Island. He had steered his father's Bertram right into a concrete bulkhead, smashing it to smithereens. "I thought I was a quarter mile offshore," Roberto explained, "because I could hear a bell buoy off the port bow." "Rather sadly," said Dickie, "the bell buoy turned out to be the supper bell on the McElroy's veranda." As Dickie spoke, he made animated and democratic eye contact with all the girls, and he punctuated the details of his story with assurances of shared familiarity. "Oh, you know how the fog is off Fisher's Isle. You know how those Bertrams come about like a barge.
You know dinner at the McElroys? 3 grand dams and 22 cousins gathered round a rib roast like cubs around the kill. Yes, Dickie, we knew. We knew the curmudgeonly old gent who stood behind the bar at Maury's in New Haven. We knew how dull was the crowd at Maidstone. We knew the Dobsons and the Robsons and all the Fenimores. We knew a jib from a jibe and Palm Beach from Palm Springs. We knew the difference between a sole fork, a salad fork, and that special fork with the bent tines used for the breaking the kernels of corn when it's served on the cob. We all knew each other so well. And therein lay the first of two unanticipated advantages of taking a job at the Pembroke Press: presumption. For a young woman, the pay at Pembroke was so bad, and the professional prospects so poor, it went without saying that you took the job because you could absolutely afford to do so. "Who are you working with?" one of the girls had asked in the cab. "Nathaniel Parrish." "Oh, how terrific. How do you know him?" "How did I know him? My father and he went to Harvard? Grandma and Mrs. Parrish grew up summering in Kennebunkport? I spent the semester in Florence with his niece? Honey, you can take your pick." Now, Katie sort of befriends this group and spends some time getting to know this crowd. But on the next day, when she goes into work, her boss encourages her to go meet with an old protege of his, a man named Mason Tate. Mason has been hired by Condé Nast to launch a new literary journal, and he's looking for some editorial assistance. And so Mr. Parrish says, you know, you should go meet with him. You've got a brighter future in his hands. And so she agrees to go meet with Mr. Tate. Mason Tate's offices were on the 25th floor of the Condé Nast building, and from the looks of them, you would have thought his forthcoming journal had been a success for years. A striking receptionist sat at a custom-made desk accented with freshly cut flowers. As I was led to Mr. Tate's office, we passed 15 young men talking on telephones or hacking away at brand new Smith Coronas. It looked like the best-dressed newsroom in America. Mr. Tate had a corner office with glass walls. The top of his desk was a piece of glass, too, floating on a lazy stainless steel X. In front of his desk was a small sitting area with a couch and chair. "Come in," he called. His accent was patently aristocratic, part prep school, part Brit, part prude. He pointed a commanding finger at one of the chairs, reserving the couch for himself. "I've heard good things about you, Miss Content." "Thank you. What have you heard about me?" "Well, not very much." "Excellent. Where were you raised?"
"In New York."
"The city or state?"
"In the city," I said.
"Have you ever been to the Algonquin?"
"The hotel?"
"Yes."
"I haven't.
But do you know where it is?"
"On West 44th Street?"
"That's right. And Delmonico's. Have you dined there?"
"Isn't it closed?" I asked.
"In a manner of speaking. What did your father do?"
"Mr. Tate, what is this all about?"
"Come now, you can't be afraid to tell me how your father earned his living."
"I'll tell you what he did if you tell me why you want to know."
"Fair enough."
"He worked in a machine shop."
"Ah, a proletarian."
"I suppose."
"Let me tell you why you're here. On January 1st, I will be launching a new magazine called Gotham. Gotham will be an illustrated weekly, and its purpose will be to profile those who hope to shape Manhattan, and by extension, the world. It will be a sort of Vogue of the mind. What I am looking for is an assistant who can triage my phone calls, my correspondence, and my laundry if need be."
"Mr. Tate," I said, "I was under the impression that you were looking for an editorial assistant for a literary journal."
"You were under that impression because that is what I told Nathan. If I had told him I was recruiting a lackey for my glamour magazine, he would never have recommended you to me."
"Or vice versa," I said. Mr. Tate narrowed his eyes. He pointed his commanding finger at my nose.
"Precisely. Come over here."
We walked to a drafting table by the window overlooking Bryant Park. On it were candid photographs of Zelda Fitzgerald, John Barrymore, and one of the younger Rockefellers.
Everyone has their virtues and vices, Miss Content. In rough terms, Gotham will cover the city's lights, its lovers, its letters, and its losers. He gestured to the three photographs on the table. Can you tell me which of those categories these people would fall under?
They're all of the above.
He gritted his teeth and smiled. Well said. Relative to your life with Nathan, working for me would be quite different. Your pay would double, your hours triple, and your purpose quadruple. But there is one hitch. I already have an assistant.
Do you really need two?
Hardly. My expectation is to run you both ragged until January 1st, and then let one of you go.
I'll forward my resume.
For what?
To apply.
This isn't an interview, Miss Content. This is an offer. You may accept it by being here tomorrow at 8.
He went back around his desk.
Mr. Tate?
Yes?
You haven't told me yet why you wanted to know my father's profession.
He looked up surprised.
Isn't it obvious, Miss Content? I cannot abide debutantes. On the morning of Friday, July 1st, I had a low-paying job at a waning publisher and a dwindling circle of semi-acquaintances. On Friday, July 8th, 1 week later, I had 1 foot in the door of Condé Nast and the other in the door of the Knickerbocker Club, the professional and social circles that would define the next 30 years of my life. That's how quickly New York City comes about, like a weather vane or the head of a cobra. And time tells which. Thank you.
Thank you. With that in mind, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Yes, in the blue hat.
Did your publisher give you any kind of grief about how you display when characters were talking because you didn't put quotation marks?
Trying to remember. I don't think so. I'm certainly not the first person who's done that. Whether, you know, James Joyce or Cormac McCarthy, others have written dialogue and narratives without quotation marks. For me, and maybe the editor at one point said, would you consider? And I said, no. And that was the end of the conversation. But for me, what ended up happening is that I was writing the first draft, and about 50 pages into the first draft or 60 pages into the first draft, I was using quotations, as I've always used them. I've written since I was a kid. And they were kind of driving me crazy. And the reason that they were bugging me is really related to their principal utility. And that is that a quotation mark is designed to allow the writer to interrupt something that is being said and to insert an observation, a modification, a hint, you know. So, is the car outside? You know, he said to, you know, his wife, you know, brusquely, you know, with, you know, one hand on his keys, you know, because I need to get, you know, to the office immediately or whatever. You know, that's the purpose of the quotation marks, is that it allows you to kind of insert this little thing that either gives you a little bit better visualization, a little bit better sense of tone or sentiment. You know, he said, you know, impatiently or sweetly or with his eyebrow raised, whatever. And that sort of provides a little bit of lazy room for a writer. And it was kind of bugging me. It was slowing down the exchanges because I was making use of that tool. And so I began stripping away the quotation marks. And what that forces you to do is to eliminate those little elements and ideally build the scene in such a way that the reader reading the rapid exchange can see all that. You know exactly, you know, you have a sense of when someone's being sarcastic or when someone is hesitating or when someone is being suddenly frank. But I wanted it to come through the exchange, person to person, and less through this kind of tipped in commentary. So, and once I got started on rewriting without him, it just shot ahead. It made me feel much better. I don't know if that's a good answer, but it's a fact.
Very good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes.
You start out with the Walker Evans exhibit, and I felt like I could see the photograph.
Yep. Have you seen the exhibit? Was there a specific photograph, or
No. Thank you. I made up a lot. Don't take a history test based on what you've read in my book, because you will fail it. But yeah, you know, obviously what she's speaking about, for those of you who haven't read the book, and I'm sorry, this is dark and small, but let me see if I find a better one. But well, they're all going to be dark and small. But anyway, the background is Walker Evans, the great American photographer, who's probably best known for the work he did with James Agee, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, where he was taking pictures of rural Americans during the Depression, you know, sort of the gingham dresses and the clabbered houses and the whole thing. But in the late 30s, he was living in New York City, and he began taking portraits of whoever was sitting across from him on the subway with a hidden camera. Now, he took 500 of these over the course of a couple of years. And upon reviewing them, he felt that he'd invaded the privacy of the individuals, so he wouldn't show them. And in 1966, about 30 years later, the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, approached him and said, how about now? Would you show the photographs now? And he agreed to. Now, you know, so going to your question, as a younger man, I'm 47, I was 25 at the time, I saw a collection of those photographs in book form. It's called Many Are Called. You can still buy that book, which was the title that Evans gave to the group of photographs. I was going through the book, and they're these quite haunting, these photographs, because the people are kind of looking straight ahead, as I describe in the preface. You know, they don't know they're being photographed. Their minds are wandering. They're very real. And I, you know, struck by them. I was going through them. And suddenly I thought to myself, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if somebody at the opening in 1966 at MoMA recognized an old friend from the 30s? And I kept going through the pictures, and I thought, oh, even better. What if the person recognized the same friend in two photographs, but the friend had undergone such a transformation between the two pictures that this person was the only one in the room who would even know it was the same person in the two pictures? And that, I was like, okay, idea for a book. Write that down. So no joke, you know, I did that. And so, and I throw that in a box. I got a box. You throw it in a box, right? And so I was setting out to write a new manuscript in my early 40s. And I went back to the box, and, you know, 20 years later, I pulled that out. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is good. I'll do this. So, the origin of this particular story comes out of having seen those photographs, which I think you can almost tell by how the preface starts, that, you know, that's the origins of it in many ways. Yes. I work for a firm called Select Equity. There's about 75 of us in the firm, so it's sort of a small to mid-sized firm.
And are you transitioning?
Yeah, every day. I shifted to halftime in January, so that allows me a little bit more freedom to pursue writing more actively, mm-hmm. rather than to squeeze it in as I have had to in the past. But it's been a great career. It's a fun job. I have a fun job, fun colleagues, fun clients. We have a fun process. It's been a good career for me for 20 years. Yes, in the back.
What do you think happened to Evie?
Oh, you know, it's so funny you say that. I mean, maybe you were partly asking for this reason, but when I finished the final draft of the manuscript, you know, you're kind of like, okay, that's that. And you ship it off, it's done. I really had no sort of lingering compulsion or sense of purpose to follow Katie or Tinker a page further. Not because I didn't like them, not because I was bored with them, but because, you know, I felt that this is as much as you and I should know about those two people, you know, and that I actually almost feel like anything that I could tell you afterwards would undermine this. It might be fun to read that, but it would undermine this. And so I was sort of like, that's done. And but, you know, in the days that followed completion of the manuscript, the thing that kept coming back to me, like at night in bed kind of thing, was, I wonder what Eve is doing in Hollywood. Like, I kept saying, it's like, God, you know, I bet she's causing trouble there. So that actually, I am this close to finishing about a 50-page short story that follows Eve to Hollywood for the fun of it, and anybody who goes to amortolls.com, my website, and sends me their email address through the contact page, I will send you that story upon completion, which will be hopefully like a week from now. But I promised it January 1, and it's now late mid-July, so you know, sorry about that.
Did you say what year?
Yeah, no, I think I might, that, next time I won't do that. Thank you for that tip. Yes. I was, I was involved in I was invited to come and discuss pitches for the potential cover of the book, and you know, it's probably a group of eight of us in the room, you know, editor, publisher, my agent, me, you know, people from design, design group, the head of paperback too, you know, all kind of there, and it was their first pitch. You know, they held up the photograph and said, "This is our first take." And it looked very much like this. A few things have changed since, but you know, maybe the color of the I think we blue chose later. It was originally white, maybe. And but nonetheless, it was pretty unanimous. Like around the table, immediately everybody's like, "Ooh, wow, that's pretty good." And it's a stock, it's a photograph from the Condé Nast files. It's from the 1930s, so it's a real picture. It's probably a staged picture, meaning Condé Nast probably took it on a stage basis to illustrate something that they were doing. But nonetheless, yeah, I thought it was great. And well, this is kind of a funny little thing, but as we were going around the table, people were responding to it. I had a sense that my agent wasn't fully, you know, behind it. And so in a break in the meeting, you know, I kind of pulled her aside and I said, you know, "Dorian, you know, I sense that, you know, that you don't love this cover. I mean, I think it's very sexy and glamorous. You know, but I want to know what you think." And she said, "Well, it's sexy and glamorous, but..." I was like, "Dorian, there's no sentence in the English language you can finish by saying it's sexy and glamorous, but, you know, you're not going to be able to do that." So anyway, she came around to it too, and we ended up, but I think it's a terrific. My wife was a little concerned about putting a young woman on the cover for fear that it would imprint readers with, you know, some expectation of what one of the what Katie in particular looked like. And I liked it because I don't think it's clear that it's Katie. It could be Eve. It could be, you know, Bitsy. You just don't know. It's part of it. It could be multiple young women in the book, and I think that's part of the fun of the photograph. Yes.
Would you share with us your process of writing, and when you do it, how long do you do it at a time, what kind of mood do you set?
Yeah.
How does it work for you?
Okay. Carbohydrates, coffee, music, you know. So it requires a little bit of background because having written since I was a kid, you know, your process evolves. And it's different for different projects, it's different times of your life. But in this case, the background is that between the age of 25 and 35, I didn't write at all. Those are the first 10 years of us trying to build our firm. And, you know, we were very focused on that craft and trying to ensure that we did a good job for ourselves, for our colleagues, for our clients. And so I just didn't write from 25 to 35. And but I knew I needed to get back to it, or I'd really probably run the risk of ending up, you know, a bitter drinker in my older age if I didn't try to apply myself. You know, and now I'm just a drinker, as we like to say. But nonetheless, I knew I had to get back. So in my mid-30s, I set out to write a book. It was set in rural Russia. It was from the perspective of five different characters. Every time you shifted view, you know, the tone had to change, the language, the psychology, the momentum of the communication. And this proved to be a very difficult structure, given that I have a full-time job and two young kids, and I'm lucky if I get 5 hours in a week to work. So that was a problem with that book. I didn't outline that book very carefully. I didn't invent the characters very carefully. So when I set out to do this book, I decided to make those changes. It would be from a single focus perspective, so I would kind of always know where I was. It would be carefully outlined, you know, so I would know in advance what was going to happen. The characters would be invented in advance. But there was one other important observation for me, which was that in reviewing that 7-year failed manuscript, most of my favorite parts were parts that I had written in the first year and never changed. And there were sections that I'd been writing for 7 years, you know, consistently editing, that still drove me crazy. So I said, all right, if I'm going to outline this carefully in advance and design the characters, what if I gave myself 12 months to write the book? You know, see if I can just capture that sense of freshness that comes in that initial burst of creativity, you know, probably in most art forms. So that's what I did. I designed the book in the fall of 2005. I started the book on January 1st, 2006, and I finished the book on New Year's Eve of that year. Not coincidentally, the book starts on, in essence, January 1st and ends a year later. The book has 26 chapters because the year has 52 weeks, and I wanted to write a chapter for a week, edit it for a week, and then move on. Almost like laying bricks in a walkway. You know, I just wanted to keep moving. So that was a pretty disciplined structure. You know, it's not one I've done in the past, but it worked certainly for this project, you know, and worked for me in general. In terms of getting a little bit more specific, what ended up being very helpful for me is that when my first child was born, he's 10, my wife and I got in the habit that on Saturday or Sunday, sometimes both, we'd have breakfast together as a family, you know, the four of us. Then I would, let's say, take the kids from 9 to 1. And, you know, we'd shoot off to the museum and, you know, and then we'd have lunch. But by 1 o'clock, you know, I was like, don't do that. Put that down. You know, leave your sister alone. And then but my wife would then take the kids from 1 to 5. And when she would walk through the door, the kids would go, Mom, you know, oh, my God, you know, Dad's driving us crazy. So, but it turned out to be really productive for everybody, you know. So, and what that meant was that I would have a four or five hour block. I had known in advance it was coming. It was uninterrupted. And very importantly for a young parent, it was without guilt for me because I paid for it that morning. and my wife didn't begrudge it, which is, you know, of course, the other thing that can happen, which is problematic because she'd had her freedom, you know, earlier that day. And so over the course of the week, what I would do is I'd plan for that window of time. So I had my outline. I knew that, you know, okay, this is going to be the chapter where Katie's going to needs to run into Anne. You know, how about at a racetrack? Okay, you know, it's going to be at a racetrack. And as I'm walking to work, I'm inventing that, you know, and say, okay, hey, well, what if it wasn't? You know, initially it was at the race, at the Beaumont Stakes. Well, no, you know, that's just too much. What if they have a, you know, a running of the horses at dawn? And that's where they run into each other, you know. And so, because that's an invention, the concept of the runarounds I made up. But as I would walk along, you sort of invent a little dialogue, you get a little bit of thematics, you get an image, such that my main ambition was that by Saturday morning, I wanted to have a number of things that I was excited about fleshing out. Because the worst thing for me, given my constrained time, would be to sit down at, you know, 1 p.m. when my wife and kids just left the door and I don't know what to do. You know, and the clock is ticking and it's white paper and you start to get frustrated, you know. So anyway, that was my process. And yes, coffee, carbohydrates, music. I like to write to music. I do. Yes.
The characters and lives in the novel are so vivid and palpable.
Thank you. I have been approached by a number of people to option the book for film. I just haven't said yes to anybody yet. I made a decision that I really wasn't going to make a decision for at least a year. You know, the book came out last July, and we actually began receiving offers a month before the book was published. But Hollywood kind of works that way. People want to get in and solidify something or corner something. And I was just like, you know what? I want the book to be out there. You know, wanted to find an audience. You know, I'm focusing on that right now, and this is a distraction, and I'll wait for a year and see what happens. And so, I think that this fall, a decision will be made about that. Now, whether it ends up being a movie or not, you never know, because Hollywood's nuts. But I mean that in the best of ways. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't pose me any trepidation, hesitation, difficulty. I think there are some writers who gain terrific artistic energy from exploring their own lives, or in essence, not necessarily in an autobiographical sense, but at least their milieu. You know, you think of Chekhov or Raymond Carver. You know, Raymond Carver as a writer gained terrific artistic energy from exploring that little linoleum topped kitchen table, you know, the day that Someone's just lost their job, and the husband and wife are having a beer, and they're, you know, the refrigerator's about is busted, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to make it, you know, keep the marriage together, get through life, raise the kids. And that was absolutely Raymond Carver's life. And he explored that world again and again and again, and it's terrific. Fabulous work. I'm the other kind of writer, which is that I gain artistic energy from displacement. I do not want to write a book about being a kid in the suburbs in Boston in the 70s. I just would never do it. Over the course of, you know, 30 years, I've written from the perspective of, you know, young black boy in the South, old Viennese, you know, violin dealer, you know, whatever. I'll take on any personality that the story requires, and that's part of the fun for me. I think it makes me a sharper observer. Now, I'd also like to say, though, that I think that in a way we've gotten to the point where we're a little bit more surprised when writers write from a different perspective than 100 years ago, than a reader 100 years ago would have thought. I mean, you think of, certainly Shakespeare wrote, Shakespeare's ambition was to depict humanity, you know, whether it was, you know, Othello as a Moor, or Shylock as a Jew, or, you know, Juliet versus Romeo. Romeo's no more alive than Juliet in that text, or for us as readers. His ambition was to create humanity, a window on humanity, human psychology. And I think that that's continues to be, you know, hundreds of years later, the principal goal of serious narrative writing is to create a glimpse of humanity and to allow the various psychologies to interact and the paradoxes of human life to express themselves and be grappled with. You know, that's what writing is about. I think that what happened, this is a sweeping, unsupported generality I'm about to make, you know, my 10th of the night, but we had this terrific development in American letters in the 1960s and 70s, which was that we suddenly had an opportunity for a whole array of narrative voices in America that had not been heard to find an outlet and join the canon. And it starts with, you know, sort of black American writing, and you suddenly get, you know, the African American female fiction, you know, of the 70s. You get Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and their peers doing terrific work. It was Asian American, you know, women's writing with Amy Tan and you know, Maxine Hong Kingston and Louise Erdrich writing about life on the reservation. But it was people writing about, you know, gangs, about urban life, about gay life in America. And as I say, this was a terrific thing. It's kind of an explosive thing of having all these various voices describing a new aspect of American society that may not have been fully voiced before, and it had stylistic implications and thematic implications and social implications. Terrific. A side effect, though, is I think that our generation has gotten kind of used to the idea that a writer sitting down to do a project is going to depict their slice of life. And in fact, if you think about the biggest literary scandals of the last 20 years, they're all about authors of books that people love and have praised turning out not to be what they thought they were. You know, whether that's James Frey or, but you know, there's been other scandals with, you know, literally the prostitute in Los Angeles, the Hispanic prostitute in Los Angeles, turns out to be a white guy in Ohio, and everybody's up in arms. What we thought it was a memoir, you know, but to me it is that the scandal that is this sort of embedded expectation now of this authenticity, whereas I say for hundreds of years authenticity wasn't the purpose of narrative fiction. As I say, it was a depiction of human life. That's different. Yes. Thanks.
And I was wondering, was that your hobby, or why did you pick this era of the 30s, or,
aside from, I love the period 1900 to 1940 in general. I think it's a fascinating period in the cultural history of the West. Now, I love the Renaissance. I think that's fascinating, you know, and I love you know, as I've written elsewhere, I love jazz in the 1950s. I love the 70s cop shows, too. I mean, I like a lot of things. But culture in 1900 to 1940, an interesting aspect of it for me is that in the 19th century, the novel and painting were evolving at a pretty observable pace. You look at an 1820s painting and an 1890s painting, it was evolving but slowly. Similar with fiction. You hit around 1900, and suddenly what happens is things accelerate in this crazy way. You know, you get cubism, you know, surrealism, you know, radically changing the way that we could think of what a painting could be. You get James Joyce and Virginia Woolf radically changing what we think a narrative could be. But you also get the skyscraper, and then you get quickly Le Corbusier, you know, creating, inventing, you know, modern buildings of a striking kind and with theories behind him. You get the adoption of Sigmund Freud's ideas. He's kind of a late 19th century figure, but it's really 1900 and forward where they're being adopted more broadly as a way of thinking about this is the shape of the human mind. You know, Marxism, again, late 19th century or mid-19th century idea, but it wasn't really experimented with until the 20th century, you know, in with the Russian Revolution. Manufacturing, airplane travel, movies, jazz music, you know, this period of 3 decades, you know, 4 decades, was jam-packed with creative combustion, you know, and that's probably not a coincidence. So I found it to be a terrific period in which to dwell. I like the, you know, I like to watch the movies. I like to listen to the music. I like to read the books. I like to study the paintings. So when I set out, so I'm kind of attracted to that in general. The 30s has this added element for me that I think it's sort of uniquely fascinating in this kind of crazy paradox of it. And this is sort of maybe New York is the epitome of this paradox, but it was American fact. Is the 30s is the Depression. From beginning to end, right? It starts in October 29 with the stock market crash, and it ends with the march to war in 39. It is exactly the decade. And we all know what the Depression was. We can visualize it. You know, it's the breadlines, and it's the, you know, the Dust Bowl people, and, you know, Woody Guthrie, and social unrest beginning to surface, and, you know, the union movement gaining ground, and fortunes having been lost. All this is true. But that decade, 1929 to 1939, was the decade in which Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers made all of their movies. And it was the decade in which the Marx Brothers made all of their most important films. Well, they made over maybe 15 movies, but the 5 that matter were made in that 10-year period. You know, Night at the Opera, Day at the Races, you know, Horse Feathers, Animal Crackers. It was the decade of swing music. Jazz began in the 20s, but it really wasn't until the, you know, very end of the 20s and into the 30s that it was really transformed into swing. And that has its apogee at the end of the 30s, 1938, when Benny Goodman and an interracial orchestra were invited to play at Carnegie Hall. And that was broadcast on the radio, which was really the first time that jazz was transmitted over the airwaves across America. But nonetheless, swing was kind of a development of the 30s, too. And I like to think of if you had something from outer space and you said, I'm going to give you a decade and I want you to interpret, you know, this decade, what it was like, and I'm going to give you 3 artifacts. You know, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie, you know, with the top hat and the big marble steps and the pearls and everything. Marx Brothers movie with his madcap comedy. Swing music, you know, Benny Goodman. There is no way that that Martian would come up with the Depression as being the decade that created that. You know, there's just no way. And that, I love that about the decade, because these things were happening kind of simultaneously. There was a certain glamour to it. There was innovation. It was a very optimistic period, actually, in sort of interesting ways. That's when Rockefeller Center was built. And if you go and look at Rockefeller Center, it is not a pessimistic, beaten-down, starving edifice. It is, we're going to win. You know, that is what it is saying. You know, the future's coming, we're going to run it, you know, as a country. So with the statues of Atlas in front and Prometheus behind. But just the architecture alone says that. So I think it's a fascinating period. But in the spirit of your question, I guess I should add, and I'm sorry if I'm going on too long on this one, but in setting out to write this book, I decided I would not do any applied research. So I would rely on my rough familiarity with that period, my voyeuristic knowledge of it as a foundation. And I would invent from there. And, you know, I fact-checked at the end, and imperfectly. You know, there's still some facts wrong in the hardcover edition. I fixed some of them in the paperback edition. But it was really about picture it yourself. And here's why I didn't do applied research, for me. Different writers have different processes.
I'm very suspicious of applied research and what it can do to fiction and narrative tone. I like to think that if you took a French person and you said, all right, write a book on suburban America in the early to mid 60s, you know, and here's all this stack of Life magazines and whatever else that you can do your research in. And they would run the risk that somewhere in that book is the young girl is coming into the kitchen, you know, the main character, and she sees her mom getting dinner ready, that the sentence is, she came into the kitchen as her mother took the bird's eye frozen peas out of the Frigidaire as the Beatles sang Love, Love Me Do on the radio. And it's like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me, right? Clunk, 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 you know, tumbling down the stairs with those nice little facts. And so and you see that in writing sometimes, you know, those kind of things that are supposed to tell us, okay, right, we're in 1962. When in fact, if you were that little girl, I like to think that if you were being asked to remember this day in your life, one of the things that would stand out is that incredible thing of when you're cooking frozen peas, that there's that little thin cardboard sleeve and the peas come out in the shape of a brick and you break the brick over boiling water. Like, what an incredible thing that is. And inevitably, some of the frozen peas scatter around the counter and inevitably a kid will eventually eat one of the frozen peas. You know, oh, that's what a frozen pea tastes like. You know, and it's not so bad. Now, meanwhile, let's say the mother, in this case, the young girl doesn't know this, but the mother earlier that day has initiated an affair with the guy next door. And after, you know, years or months of feeling, you know, lonely or old, you know, she's suddenly feeling, you know, revived and a full flush of love. Or let's say she just found out that her husband's cheating on her. You know, and she doesn't know what's going to happen to her, and maybe the family's going to fall apart, and she's feeling rotten. Either way, the kid wouldn't know, right? Maybe later in this story, the kid's going to find out that that was the day that this happened. But depending on which of those two things happened, every word in that scene would have to be different, you know, basically, right? Even though the kid doesn't know what the mother's gone through, and we, the readers, don't know yet, right? The way that you would describe that interaction over the stove, her response to the music, how quickly she moved, how she looked at her, all that would have to some degree have that embedded in it. And to me, that's, you know, what the artistic mission and narrative, right, is to have that feeling of walking through the door and seeing it, you know, freshly, just like it is, even grabbing the details that you don't even understand their importance yet as the viewer. And I think that applied research is the enemy of that process. That's for me. One more question. Go for it.
What's on your nightstand as you're reading?
What is on my nightstand that I am reading? I just finished with my friends. I have a group of four friends that we read together, two men and two women. We're old friends. We've been reading together for about a decade. We just did Henry IV and Henry V, parts one and two. The Shakespearean histories. I'd never read them. It was totally fun. But because of that, we're reading actually Wolf Hall right now, because we kind of were getting excited about the whole Shakespearean environment. And so we're giving ourselves a summer break and reading that. But that's what I'm doing right now. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.